Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, brought to you in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM 89.5 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Let me ask you something. Where are you from? I don't mean right now. I mean maybe earlier in your life, or maybe a generation or two back in your family. In fact, that's really the question I'm asking. Where is your family from? What country do you hail from? Relatively few of us native to this continent. Our parents came over, or grandparents came over, maybe from someplace in Europe or Asia or Africa or South America. Most of us are from someplace else if we go back far enough. So think about that for a minute. Where's your family primarily from? Now think about this. Think about what would happen if suddenly the United States was at war with the country of your family's origin. You think that sounds far-fetched? Oh, I'm from Britain, you say, or my family is all English or Scottish. We'd never fight a war with Britain. Really? I think we've already done that, I think twice that I can think of. Or I'm from Germany. Oh, sorry. At least a couple of times with them. France. Oh, well, we almost went to war with France in the 1790s. In fact, name lots of countries from where lots of Americans come from, and we've been at war with many of them. So that's not at all far-fetched. Now, let me ask you to imagine something else. Imagine that shortly after war breaks out between the United States and the country of your family's origin, that there comes a knock on your door, that notices go up, that the government announces that you are to leave your home, you are to leave your business, you are to leave your property behind, and with only two suitcases, you and every member of your family, from babes in arms to grandma and grandpa, are going to live in a concentration camp. You are now under suspicion as a saboteur. You are considered to be an alien, an enemy alien, even though you may have been born in this country, because your family comes from another country with which the United States is now at war. Couldn't happen, could it? We don't do those things. Concentration camps, the other countries have done those things. Guess again. Think back to December 7th, 1941. Think back to what happened that day. Think back to what happened to Japanese Americans. And I emphasize the American part of that. People of Japanese descent who lived in this country, who were citizens, were rounded up. Thousands upon thousands of them were rounded up, and they were taken in the manner I've just described. They were put behind barbed wire with armed guards in concentration camps. One of the sorriest episodes in American history. And of those thousands upon thousands of people, only a very few protested. Only a very few raised their hands and said, "Wait, this isn't right. In fact, our rights are being violated. We have rights under our Constitution, and you must respect them, America." Perhaps the most famous of those very few that protested at the time was Fred Korematsu. Now, Fred Korematsu took his case all the way to the United States Supreme Court, and without giving away too much, I'll simply tell you that the Korematsu case, along with two or three others, is considered to be one of the most infamous cases in the history of the United States Supreme Court. There's quite a story here. And to tell it to you, I have the great honor of speaking to Fred's daughter, Karen Korematsu. Now, I hoped to meet Karen when I was out on a trip to San Francisco recently, where she is one of the people in charge of the Korematsu Institute in San Francisco. We crossed paths. We didn't actually get to speak when I was in San Francisco, but subsequently, we got on the telephone together. And today and next week, I'm going to share with you Karen Korematsu's compelling story of her father, Fred Korematsu, All-American.
I'm Fred Korematsu's daughter, and I am the co-founder of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute for Civil Rights and Education, a program of the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco. And I am carrying on my father's legacy by crisscrossing the United States and public speaking to schools and organizations, law schools, and also giving workshops to teachers.
Well, I can personally attest to the fact that you crisscrossed the country because you were actually crossing the country while I was crossing it, and I think our planes passed each other as I was flying to San Francisco and you were flying to Washington, D.C. from San Francisco, which is why I'm talking to you over the telephone rather than having interviewed you when I was out in San Francisco. So you're a busy woman.
Correct. Yes, very busy. It's wonderful to have this increasing interest in my father's story and also about the Japanese American internment during World War II.
Absolutely. It's a very important tale, and a lot of people don't know much of anything about it, and that's why we're here today. So why don't we start at the beginning? Why don't you tell me who Fred T. Korematsu was and why we're talking about him today?
Well, my father was born in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1919. And grew up as an all-American kid, just like other kids do today. My grandparents came over from Japan in the early 1900s, and my grandfather was a flower nursery business person, and my father would sometimes help him. My father was the third son of four boys, and in situation, it's the first son is the one that can do no wrong, supposedly, and is the shining light. The second son is the spare to the heir, so to speak. Then mm-hmm. you have my father, who's always seemed to be the third man out because there was a fourth son that was the baby. So he always was assigned the jobs around in the flower nursery that no one else wanted to do, the hoeing, the weeding, the painting.
He was a middle child.
Yes.
Well, I'm a middle child, so I sympathize with him in that regard.
So he grew up loving everything about America and hung out with his friends and loved hot dogs and going to sports games. He was in high school. He was on the tennis team and a golf club and a swim team. And most of his friends actually were Caucasian, even though he was Japanese American. But he learned about the Constitution and history in high school. And so certainly when Pearl Harbor occurred on December 7th, 1941,
How old was he then? He would have been
19. He would have been 22 then. He hadn't quite had his birthday yet. So at the time of Pearl Harbor, he was 22.
And as a natural-born American citizen, there's a term for that, isn't there? Is it Nisei?
Yes, he was second generation. That's
right.
A Japanese term for second generation. And my grandfather or my grandparents were Issei, mm-hmm. meaning first generation.
Okay.
And actually, I'm Sansei, which is third generation.
Okay. Okay, so he's 22 years old, and Japan attacks. A shocking day for everybody, and I imagine particularly unpleasant for Japanese Americans.
Well, absolutely, and very, very scary for my grandparents.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific.
Certainly, my father thought that maybe something might happen to them because they weren't American citizens. But it wasn't because they didn't want to. It was because of the laws at the time. And but my father, being an American, didn't even think that his civil rights would be violated.
Let's clarify that. So your grandparents had been allowed to emigrate to the United States, but they had not been allowed to actually become citizens.
That's correct. That's correct. And
that was simply because they were from Japan.
That's right, okay. And because of the laws at the time.
Yeah. Now, constitutionally speaking, it's an interesting quirk in our laws that immigration is one of those things that Congress has complete and total control over. In fact, we like to say that they have plenary power, which means that Congress can do pretty much what it wants to do with immigration, including enacting laws that look very unfair to us in retrospect. And that was actually something that Congress did quite a bit of throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, and arguably even today. I mean, we're still arguing over immigration statutes. But the reason that Congress can very clearly discriminate in this area and in ways that don't always seem fair is because Congress's constitutional authority over immigration is total. And so that's what his parents were facing then.
Yes, that's correct. And also that's why my father's story is so relevant today, because we still are, as you said, discussing these issues of immigration. And you know, back then you were labeled, you know, alien and non-alien, and now it's an issue of documented and undocumented. So 70 years later, you know, the terms may have changed, but some of the issues are still the same.
Mm-hmm.
But before the war, I must add, there was talk of the draft. America knew that they were probably going to be getting into World War II. And so my father and his buddies, you know, one night sitting around playing cards, decided that if there was going to be a draft, that if they enlisted together, then they could stay together. And so my father and his friends went to the post office. That's how you enlisted at that time. And they would have these long rows of tables, and at first they went to the National Guard desk and tried to get applications. Well, the military officer gave the application to my father's Caucasian's friends, but he refused to give my father an application because he learned that he was, you know, Japanese ancestry. So one of his buddies said, "Well, come on, Fred. Let's go down, you know, to the Coast Guard desk." And here again, the military officer, gave the applications to his buddies, but the officer told my father he had orders not to give my father an application. And my father said, "But I'm an American. I want to serve." And he was totally embarrassed and confused and upset that he was being treated in this regard. I mean, he had experienced some discrimination even in high school when he wanted to go get a haircut in a barbershop kind of in the next town. And the man kind of shooed him out and said, "Oh, no, get out of here. We don't cut hair of your kind. You go down to Chinatown to get your haircut." And then he was also had that same experience when he tried to go to a local diner in the town next to him. And they refused to serve him. "Oh, go down to Chinatown. You don't belong here."
Right.
So his experiences of discrimination came early. And so when...
But let me just clarify. This is 1941, before Pearl Harbor, that your dad twice tried to enlist in the military and was twice simply refused.
Yes, that's correct. But he wanted to believe in the military effort, and so he did... he became a welder and worked in the shipyards before Pearl Harbor.
In San Francisco?
In the East Bay in Oakland.
Okay.
He wanted to do his part, even though he had been totally, really been denied some of his rights to serve in this country. So when President Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066 on February 19th, 1942, which gave the military the authority to force remove anyone of Japanese ancestry from the West Coast, and put them in internment camps, American concentration camps, if you will, in throughout the United States. And this was done, mind you, without any due process. There were no hearings, there were no charges, there was no day in court. But just because you looked like the enemy, you were incarcerated.
Well, how did that executive order come about? I mean, we had Pearl Harbor, obviously, and we've got an emergency, and it's understandable. People are upset and they're concerned and all the rest of it, and that's in early December of 1941. But then who suggested that it was necessary or appropriate to exclude people of Japanese ancestry from areas around the West Coast? How did this come about?
Well, the President Roosevelt actually, declared war right after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, December 8th, yeah.
December 8th. So that
went before Congress, yeah.
That put America into World War II, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the military was very powerful at that time. And also in up and down the West Coast, the backstory is that when the Japanese came over, like the Issei, like my grandfather, that came over from Japan, worked in farming all up and down the West Coast. And that they were very successful. And a lot of people were very jealous of that. And they wanted the Japanese out and wanted the land taken away from them. That was the backstory.
Mm.
But also, just because of the military, they really, in the end, kind of fabricated stories that eventually went to the Supreme Court, where my father's case was heard.
Well, let's not get ahead of it, though. Let's tell it in order. So, apparently, the military, perhaps in conjunction with other people who were jealous of the success of the Issei and the Nisei, suggested that it was appropriate somehow to exclude people of Japanese ancestry from these areas, including American citizens, American-born citizens, like your father, from these areas. And they apparently convinced the president in this immediate aftermath of Pearl Harbor. And so he issues this executive order. And what effect does it have?
Well, it's detrimental to the to the Japanese and Japanese Americans. I mean, anybody of Japanese ancestry by that point had been demonized, and so the military felt that in order to supposedly make the West Coast safe, that they would incarcerate everyone. However, they did not do so for the most part in Hawaii. There was a Department of Justice camp, but the majority of people in Hawaii were of Japanese ancestry, and actually it would have shut down the island economically if they had done that.
That's where the real threat was. I don't think they'd ever really seriously planned to invade the West Coast of the United States, but strangely, we had Japanese internment on the West Coast, but not in Hawaii.
Correct.
Where the threat was arguably much, much greater. And you say that was simply, a matter of economic necessity?
Yes. It would. A lot of the people that had businesses there were actually supplying Pearl Harbor, the military there.
That would have been hard, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, that's the kind of the irony to the story, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The military certainly protects its own interest.
Okay.
Obviously.
Wow. Okay. So on the West Coast, which is in a less threatening place than Hawaii was at that time, what actually started happening? I mean, how long did it take before people started getting notices that they were going to have to evacuate?
Well, first there was a curfew. So there was a curfew of that you had to be, in your home by, I think, 8 o'clock in the evening, and you could not leave before 6 o'clock in the morning. So there was that for a while. But basically, people, once the notice was issued, had, in some cases, only 48 hours to decide what to do with their belongings. I mean, can you imagine that you have a whole household, and you have to decide what you can sell, what you can give away, what you can give to friends, hoping that they're going to hold it not knowing whenever you're coming back, because you could only basically take what you could carry in two hands, which was like approximately 50 pounds each.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Karen Korematsu, the daughter of Fred Korematsu, who is perhaps the most famous resistor of the Japanese incarcerations that occurred during World War II. Excuse me, I should say the Japanese-American incarcerations that happened during World War II. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Karen Korematsu. Stay tuned.
In that morning, when Ken went out on the doormat, his world went black, cause right there, front page news, 3 weeks before 1942, Pearl Harbor's been bombed and the Japs are coming, pictures of soldiers dying and running, Ken knew what it would lead to, just like he guessed, the president said, the evil Japanese in our home country would be locked away. They gave Ken a couple of days to get his whole life packed in two bags, just two bags, couldn't even pack his clothes, some folks didn't even have a suitcase to pack anything.
And now it's time once again for our constitutional quiz, and here live from maternity leave is our quiz lady, now the quiz mom, Kelly Carmichael. Well, Kelly Carmichael, the soon-to-be quiz mom, do you have a good question for us this week?
I do.
What is it?
All right, here we are. One way a person can become a citizen, a United States citizen, is by A, buying property and paying taxes in the United States. Hmm. B, graduating from a college or university in the United States. C, opening a business in the United States in partnership with a citizen. Or D, living in the United States for 5 years and passing a special test.
So four possible routes to citizenship for those who wish to become naturalized citizens. What are those again, please, Kelly?
Sure. A person can become a United States citizen by A, buying property and paying taxes to good old Uncle Sam in the United States. B, graduating from a college or university in the United States. And I'm sure that also includes tailgating at games.
Of course.
C, opening a business in the United States in partnership with a citizen. Or D, living in the United States for 5 years and passing a special test.
Well, I know that I personally would prefer the tailgating option, but let us see what our contestant has to say. On the line with us is Elizabeth. Elizabeth.
Hello. Hi,
where are you from, Elizabeth?
I'm from Pulaski, Virginia.
Pulaski, Virginia? Now, who's Pulaski named after?
Casimir Pulaski. He was a Revolutionary War general.
Wow, you're on a roll already. He was a very important Revolutionary War general. He was from Poland, wasn't he?
Correct.
Originally, and he actually volunteered for the Continental Army.
That's right.
Well, we both know all about your hometown then, don't we? But of course, that's not what you're being quizzed on now. Yeah, I'm going to expect you to answer the question that the quiz lady asked us about citizenship. So let's go through those answer choices. Do you think it was choice A, that you, in order to be a citizen, you have to buy property and pay taxes?
I believe you can be a non-citizen and own property within the United States. So I don't believe answer choice A is correct.
I see. So that's not going to be one way you could become a citizen just by buying.
No.
Okay. Let's see here. How about B? How about graduating from a college or a university? Is that going to get you citizenship?
Again, I think non-citizens can graduate from any college in the States, and I don't think that will help you gain citizenship.
Okay. Well, okay, I guess that's true. Well, we'll see anyway. How about choice C? What if you open a business as a partner of a citizen?
Again, it's a good thing, but I don't think that will give you any points towards citizenship.
That's interesting, because I know in some countries where they really want immigrants, countries like Australia, they will offer, you know, some sort of incentive if you invest in the country. So I guess answer choice C wasn't that far off, but you still don't like C.
No, sir.
Then what about choice D? What about living in the United States for 5 years and passing a test? Is that a way to be kept?
Yeah, so I'm going to go with D. I have heard that in order to become a citizen, there is a pretty specialized test one must pass in order to become a citizen.
Is that your final answer?
Yes, sir.
All right, well, let's ask the quiz lady. So, Kelly, what's the answer to this path to citizenship question?
Well, I think that tailgating is a very important trait of being a United States citizen. The answer is D, living in the United States for 5 years and passing a special test.
5 years of residency and then passing a special test. All right, so basically that's the standard way of getting to becoming a naturalized citizen, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I mean, either you're born here, and the 14th Amendment, Section 1 says that if you are born here, then you are going to be a citizen automatically, but not everyone is that fortunate to be born in the land of the free and the home of the brave, and many other people want to join us, and so that's the way to do it. 5 years and a test. It's a test that
makes... A challenging test. It's not easy, the citizenship test.
It is not easy, and I've heard people say that maybe all of us should have to take it. It probably wouldn't do any harm, would it?
Yeah, I've certainly heard that debate among a number of our high school We the People students who talk about, you know, should we require everybody, whether you're born here or not, to take the citizenship test?
Well, it's probably unconstitutional to do so, but from a purely civics-minded perspective... From an educational
perspective. The teacher in me.
Yeah, the teacher in me, too. I don't know that that's such a bad idea. Maybe we'll have to amend the Constitution. Okay.
or you just require it of your students.
I could do that, too. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Well, in any event, Elizabeth, you passed your test, and so you get a T-shirt.
Great.
And thanks very much for playing.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Karen Korematsu about the incarceration of thousands upon thousands of Japanese Americans during World War II. So your family simply received a notice in the mail or delivered
to
you?
Well, they were on bulletin boards. The communities were pretty centralized, and so... The notices went up, and nothing was really kind of sent in the mail, so to speak.
Okay, so 48 hours from now, you report to this particular place, and you're allowed to bring two suitcases, and that's it.
You report to a detention assembly center, if you will. So for the people in the San Francisco Bay Area, they went to San Bruno, which is a suburb, where there was a racetrack, Tan Phran Racetrack. And that's where they had to report. The sad thing is people lost businesses. People were burning anything related to Japan because they didn't want to be associated with the emperor, or they didn't want people to think that they, you know, weren't Americans. Mm-hmm. Because the majority of people, two-thirds of the people that were incarcerated, were American citizens.
Yeah. And there was no trial, there was no accusation of wrongdoing, there was simply, I guess the rationale that was most commonly given was that they were concerned about sabotage.
Yes.
So they were concerned, apparently, that 3-year-old children might sabotage war plants as well as 83-year-old grandparents.
Yes, the sick and the infirmed and babies. I mean, it made no sense at all. Even I've had a kindergarten teacher say to me, "You mean they really put children in prison?" And I said, "Yes, just because they look like the enemy."
My goodness.
People lost. You know, the sad part of the story is people would give their possessions to friends, thinking, like I said, they would hold them. But some people didn't even think that the Japanese Americans were even coming back home. That was the atmosphere at the time. So their possessions ended up to be lost or sold or stolen.
Wow.
And
I imagine if they tried to sell anything, that people recognized that it was sort of a fire sale situation, and I imagine they didn't get much money for those items they did manage to sell.
Yeah, correct. Yes, correct. And people lost, you know, so much. And also their dignity. It was a very, you know, shameful time. But the reason someone asked me once, you know, why did everyone decide to go along? And it was their way of demonstrating their patriotism, you know, that they were loyal to America.
Wow. Now, before we leave the actual moment when people are actually being gathered together and sent off to the camps, and we'll get to the camps in a moment, The rationale, again, was the war had just started. It was a surprise attack. People were in shock. They had, I'm sure, legitimate concerns about sabotage. Was there ever a single incident of sabotage at any war plant or any other American facility by the Japanese Americans?
No, there was never any evidence of spying or espionage.
Of any kind? Okay.
No.
Now, I'm going to contrast that with I know of at least one circumstance where people of German-American descent, people who had been born in the United States and who then during the 1930s became Nazi sympathizers, went over to Germany. They were trained, and then they were sent back as saboteurs who came ashore on Long Island in one case and came ashore on Jacksonville, Florida, in the other case. And these people came back with bombs, with explosives, with the intent to sabotage the American war industries. So was there ever any gathering up of people of German-American descent on the East Coast?
No, there was no mass incarceration. There were some arrests at the time, but they were not arrested just because they were of German ancestry. And also the Italian-Americans.
Yeah, then they're the Italians. Anything happened
the
to
Italian,
them?
Italian nationals and were not incarcerated as well. So it was just anyone that was of Japanese ancestry.
Only the Japanese. We have three enemies we're fighting, but for some reason only the Japanese are going to be singled out for this sort of treatment.
Yes, yes.
And even though the only group that seems to have actually sent saboteurs over were the Germans.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to get the context straight. So that rationale of concerns about sabotage seems to have been at the very least misplaced. Okay. So they gather at the racetrack. What happens to your family after that?
Well, my father refused to go, and he refused to obey the military order to be forced removed from his home. He thought of himself as an American. He had a girlfriend. He wanted to stay here. He learned about the Constitution in high school and American history, and he believed that he had rights. And it was his way of protesting the incarceration, but also his way of showing his patriotism by staying home, by staying in his home and or in the Bay Area, I should say,
right,
and continue with his life.
Was he still working at the shipyard welding?
No, by that time people had let go of anyone that was Japanese ancestry that worked in the shipyards because they thought there would be some sabotage there.
Hmm. Okay, so he'd been fired from that job.
Yeah, so he had to get some side jobs. He was even denied being a supervisor, which somebody had put him forward to be just because he was of Japanese ancestry. So he continued to try to work, but about a month after everyone reported to the Tanforan racetrack in San Bruno, someone spotted him on a street corner in San Leandro, and he was arrested and put in jail. Eventually, he kind of made his way through several jails and finally ended up in San Francisco. And a gentleman named Mr. Ernest Besick read about his arrest in the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper. And Mr. Besick was then the executive director of the Northern California affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union. And he had been looking for a test case because he certainly thought that the incarceration was unconstitutional. So he visited my father in jail and asked him if he would be willing to take his case, if need be, Mr. Besick said, all the way to the Supreme Court. And that's what happened.
This was happening, and was it still 1942 at this point?
Yes, this is May. So the executive order was issued on February 19th, and my father was arrested on May 30th in 1942.
So Besig comes in, and they contest his arrest, and so legal proceedings begin. So where is your dad during all these legal proceedings? Is he still in jail?
After his first hearing, then he was sent over to the Tanforan racetrack. And, you know, he's actually said when he had his hearing, when his case was reopened in 1983, he said to the judge then in court, horse stalls are for horses, not for human beings. Because the conditions over there at that racetrack were deplorable. You know, they just had been...
Wait a minute. You said they assembled at the racetrack. I thought you meant they went there and got on buses. You mean they went stayed at
They had to live there for at least about 3 months while the military built these barracks at these internment camps throughout the United States.
So they're living in horse stalls?
They're living in horse stalls. That's correct. You know, it was just whitewashed. It still smelled like horse manure. You had a light bulb over your head, some cot that was stuffed with straw, a gap in the walls, in the floor. It was a dirt floor, and the conditions were so terrible. I mean, there was dysentery within the camp, you know, within that detention center, as in others. I mean, all up and down the West Coast. People were sent to these assembly centers, detention centers first, which were, in most cases, if they didn't have a racetrack, they found a racetrack at a fairgrounds, and then that's where they put them.
I wonder why, you'd, if you're a bureaucrat implementing this executive order, why you'd pick a racetrack. I guess it's a large open area, and they've got these stalls.
Yes.
But, I mean, the very idea that you'd put people in where horses were, I mean, I don't even know who would come up with such an idea. To begin with, I mean, there couldn't have been adequate sanitary facilities.
Well, that's true, and so everything was very temporary. I mean, they were temporary sites. But
wow, how many people were at the racetrack in the Bay Area?
There were about I think 5,000, I think, or 3,000 there. I mean, there were in the other camps, there was about 10,000 once they moved them out because they did come from different parts. There was at least 10,000 in each internment camp throughout the U.S. But
right,
they
but
ranged.
I'm still at the racetrack. I'm trying to get my mind around that. If they had several thousand humans at the racetrack, unless this was a very big racetrack, you're going to have more than one person per horse stall.
Well, they did kind of throw up some temporary barracks, if you will.
Right.
I'm just saying, you
have several people staying in each one of these stalls, I'm guessing. Entire families? Okay.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. So they stay there for several months. Your father protests that he's, you know, horse stalls are for horses, but he's living there nonetheless. And so then as his case proceeds, the next stop is where?
Topaz, Utah. That's where that particular internment camp was built for most of the people in the Bay Area.
And where is
and
Topaz?
Some other areas. Pardon?
Where is Topaz, Utah?
In the middle of nowhere. It's actually that's what the government did. They found desolate areas of land that the government owned. A lot of times they were Indian reservations. And then built these barracks. I mean, these barracks. If there's one in Lone Pine in Southern California, they recreated one that I went to for the first time a couple of years ago. And it's a long wooden barrack. It just has tar paper on the outside. You might have a stove, potbelly stove in each corner. That was your heat. There's certainly no air conditioning. And no greater heat in the wintertime. And there were sandstorms. And then they would also, for the families, would string up rope, you know, from one side of the barrack to the other. And that's how the families were designated their living areas and hung a blanket or a sheet in between the ropes.
My goodness. All right. So they get sent off to Topaz, Utah. And your dad's with his parents now?
Well, he really was vilified from day one because he went against the government. And so even his own Japanese-American community didn't want anything to do with him because they thought some harm might come to them. So, you know, he basically was alone his entire time.
You know, the United States produced at least one film that was designed to explain this mass exodus of thousands upon thousands of American citizens from their homes and businesses, to explain it to the wider public. Here's a brief clip from a film narrated on behalf of the U.S. government by Milton Eisenhower.
We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous, but no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. I'm speaking with Karen Korematsu about the incarceration of thousands and thousands of Japanese Americans during World War II. After the break, we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll come back and continue this compelling tale.
And when the kids asked Mom, where are we going? Nobody even knew what to say to them. Ken didn't want to lie. He said the U.S. is looking for spies. So we have to live in a place called Manzanar, where a lot of Japanese people are. Stop it, don't look at the gunmen. You don't want to get the soldiers wondering if you're gonna run or not. Because if you run, then you might get shot. Other than that, try not to think about it. Try not to worry about it being so crowded. But someday we'll get out. Someday, someday.
That's your name, Barbara.
Well, Lynn Yazell, welcome back to the show. What's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, I want to talk about something that actually began several months ago, but I want to make sure that people are apprised of the latest developments.
Well, that sounds exciting. What is it?
Well, on March 16th, this is Madison's birthday of 2012, we launched an online resource for James Madison's Notes of the Constitutional Convention.
Wow, and those are the definitive notes. I mean, to the extent we have definitive notes. So that's an important...
Absolutely. You know. There were other people taking notes, but either, like John Yates, they left in the middle of the convention, or like several other people, they were really only taking scraps of these debates that were taking place. But James Madison was the most assiduous note taker in the whole convention, and he sat and recorded every word that he was able to get down as the speeches were taking place. And so this is the definitive record of how the Constitution was developed.
And it's a wonderful resource. I've looked at it, of course, since it first was launched. But you're telling me now that in the summer of 2012, there have been some additions to it or some improvements?
There have been both additions and improvements. Montpelier's Center for the Constitution has taken on a few different interns. And these interns have been beavering away in the Constitutional Village in order to add additional notes and commentary on the notes of the convention, so that if you look this up, you will see not only James Madison's notes, but also context, historical commentary of what was taking place, theoretical commentary, biographical information, so that these debates can be placed in a more informative way and to make it more understandable for the modern reader.
That sounds absolutely marvelous. It sounds like one of those Hollywood shows where people are tweaking little additional facts along the edges of them. Not to trivialize it, but I mean, it's sort of the same thing. We're going to give you more information, what other people said, what other people thought throughout the last 225 years.
Right, and this information is coming from all segments of society. We have scholars who are contributing information. We have, as I said, our interns. And we have anybody who wants to can sign up and add their own commentary.
Well, thank you, Lynn Yazell. We're going to have to go and check out Context online at the Center for the Constitution. What's the website for that? Is it center.montpelier.org, right?
That is going to get you to the center website, and then within that website, you will be able to find a link to Context.
Tremendous. Thank you, Lynn Yazell. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional and our conversation with Karen Korematsu, the co-founder and a member of the advisory council of the Korematsu Institute in San Francisco. Karen is telling us all about the experiences of her family during the incarceration of thousands of Japanese Americans in World War II.
These camps that were built had to be self-sustaining, so they built hospitals, they had to build their own facilities. They had mess halls, so therefore they had to work in the kitchens. They, if they could grow anything in these areas, they tried to do that. And, you know, teachers had to bring in materials and kind of carry on with education. They did try to bring some teachers from the outside. So, but my father basically was alone. He had brought shame to his own family, so no one wanted anything to do with him.
That's got to be one of the more painful and to me, unknown aspects of this entire tale was that, you know, the Japanese-American community itself was divided. Between those, well, I mean, it's a tough situation to be in, and in many respects, but, you know, the basic decision is whether am I going to resist this or am I not going to resist it? And apparently most of them decided they didn't want to resist it. And so the resistors were the ones who were ostracized, people like your dad?
Yes, yeah. Yes. And there was another group of people that, you know, there were draft resistors once they started the draft within the Japanese American internment camps who refused, you know, to want to serve.
Okay, I have to stop you there too. Wait a second. You've put people in camps, you've taken away their civil rights, you've taken away their property effectively. You've incarcerated them. You've strung up barbed wire around them, and we didn't mention this, but there are armed military guards patrolling the perimeter, right?
Yes, and
okay.
And yet
you still send in recruiters, not even recruiters. You send in representatives of the American military and say, "You young man, you're going to be drafted."
Yes.
And that's... I my mouth falls open when I think about this. And did some people actually serve willingly?
Well, yes. And when we have the 442nd, which is the most decorated military unit in the history of the United States.
And they were comprised of Japanese-Americans drafted from the camps?
They were comprised of Japanese-Americans who went into areas of Europe in the Far East on dangerous missions. And yes, it's ironic. Your parents are in prison, and you are asked to serve your country. It's a terrible situation. It was a dilemma for a lot of people because their civil rights had been clearly violated.
It's your weekly Constitutional. We're speaking to Karen Korematsu, the co-founder of the Korematsu Institute in San Francisco, about the Japanese incarcerations, the Japanese-American incarcerations in World War II. Let's take a moment now and have our Madison Minute.
Before she married James, Dolly Madison was married to attorney John Todd of Philadelphia. Dolly married John in 1790 when she was 21 years old. From 1791 to 1793, they lived together in a modest three-story brick house on the northeast corner of 4th and Walnut Streets. John's law office was on the first floor. Dolly entertained in a parlor on the second floor. Tragically, John Todd died during a yellow fever epidemic in 1793, along with his and Dolly's younger son, three-month-old William Isaac Todd, leaving behind Dolly and their older son, John Payne Todd. Their house, now known as the Todd House, is owned by the National Park Service and is open for tours. The Todd House reflects the lifestyle of 18th-century Philadelphia's middle class and offers insights into a part of Dolly Payne Todd Madison's life that is often overlooked. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
Now let's finish today's discussion with Karen Korematsu, the co-founder and member of the advisory council of the Korematsu Institute in San Francisco. Not just your parents and your little sister who's 3 years old and your uncle who's 82 are all in this camp, and yet you willingly allow yourself to be drafted, and then you serve bravely in combat and distinguish yourself. Was that part and parcel of what we've been talking about, is the desire among these people to prove their patriotism?
Yes, that's correct.
Wow, that's extraordinary in and of itself, and that really illustrates how far many, perhaps the majority of the Japanese Americans were willing to go to demonstrate their Americanness, if you will. And that now gives the remarkable contrast with people like your father who were insisting that their civil rights shouldn't be denied. And I guess you were about to say some of them also refused to be drafted?
Yes. A few months after they had been incarcerated in these different 10, there are 10 internment camps throughout the United States, as far as Arkansas, mind you. So they're all spread out.
They're taking people from the West Coast and putting them in Arkansas.
Yes, that's correct. In Roer and Jerome, there were two camps in Arkansas.
Okay.
But the government had issued a questionnaire, a loyalty questionnaire, and you know, in view of of determining who was going to be loyal and who would be willing to serve in the military. They just looked at the Japanese Americans as being disposable, quite frankly.
Hmm.
In this questionnaire, there are as many questionnaires or questions and that people had to answer, but two of them were question 27 and 28. And the 27 question was basically, will you serve in the military, in the United States military? And the 28 was, do you deny any allegiance to the emperor and to Japan? Well, I have to point out that for someone like my grandfather, who is Issei, who is first generation, who is really has no country. He's come over from Japan. He's left Japan. He wants to have this life in America. He believes in America. He wanted to be a citizen. But now all his rights, even as an immigrant, has been taken away.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a dilemma for a lot of people. How do they answer this? And
yeah, it's the only country he arguably has, and maybe he's thinking at this point, you know, they really don't want me here. Maybe I'm going to have to go back to Japan.
Exactly.
I mean, and
exactly.
So now they're asking him to renounce his citizenship in Japan.
Yes. I mean, my grandfather did. I mean, he answered no, but there were a lot of people.
No, that he had no more loyalty to the emperor.
Correct.
Okay.
But there were many of those, there was a minority of those that did answer yes, yes. He answered yes.
He renounced his
allegiance to Japan. He couldn't serve in the military, obviously, but I guess he would if he could.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are those people that, mostly men that answered it no, no. And then they were referred to them as no, no boys.
Oh, my goodness. And so the no, no, no said, no, I won't serve in the military, and no, I refuse to renounce my or any allegiance that I might have to the emperor.
Right, right.
And they became the so-called no-nos.
Right. And also then you had the draft resistors. And there were a few descendants, those people who renounced their citizenship.
Actually renounced. And in fact, I seem to recall that there was actually an effort that happened later during the incarceration to encourage people, especially the no-nos, to renounce their citizenship.
Correct. Yes, there was pressure, all the way around. And then most of those people were sent to one of the concentration camps in Northern California called Tule Lake, and they called that the Tule Lake Segregation Center.
My goodness. Well, before we get there, what exactly did your dad answer? Was he a no-no?
No, he actually answered yes, yes on the questionnaire, but, he had already been arrested and had this case that was making its way through the court. So certainly the government didn't think he was viable for service.
Hmm.
So
he stayed there then at Topaz?
Yeah, he stayed there at Topaz.
Okay.
And towards the end of the war, I mean, the government knew that, America was going to win and Japan was going to surrender. And the government, in its, quote, wisdom, said to itself, well, what are we going to do with 120,000 people that have been incarcerated, and all of a sudden they're going to leave these camps, and where are they going to go and what are they going to do? And so they had community leaders come into these camps and try to arrange for employment in different cities. Different cities going east, you know, had different programs, and that was the case. You could go east, but you could not go west until after the war was over.
So they started releasing people, what, in 45? Excuse me, 44 and 45?
Yes.
But you could only go east.
Yes, that's correct.
This was a diaspora.
Yes. Yes, that's true. And I always kind of wondered growing up when I met somebody that, like a Japanese American, you know, sansei like me, that was born in Wisconsin. I would say, well, how in the world did you end up in Wisconsin? You know, why aren't you from the Bay Area? Like, I was just assuming everybody was. But that was what happened. I mean, people left these camps and they went east, and a lot of people just didn't even want to return to the West Coast, nor did they have anything to come back to.
Wow. Okay, so your dad was still at Topaz at this time, and so when was he released?
Well, he was released in 44. He was able to find a welding job in Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. So a few other of the guys ended up going to Salt Lake City, and so he worked there for a while. And then his youngest brother had ended up in Detroit, Michigan. So he eventually made his way there. He actually was going to go to New York because I think there was another job he had heard about, but he wanted to visit his brother first. And then that's actually where he met my mother.
Was in Detroit?
Was in Detroit, Michigan.
I see. Well, now, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves because we've skipped over, constitutionally speaking, perhaps the most significant part of this tale, and that is back in 1944, I believe, his case finally made its way all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Okay.
It had gone back to appeals, and the Supreme Court actually threw it back to appeals once even it got there the first time. The Supreme Court didn't even want to have to deal with this type of matter, and issue.
Mm-hmm.
You should know that at the time, you know, people's loyalty to the president, was very clear. And for example, Mr. Besick was even threatened to be ostracized from the National ACLU for even taking my father's case.
I have to stop you there then. Wait a second. The ACLU was not even willing to support its local branch in California in your father's case?
No. The National was not, which was based in New York. And they, because they felt like it would demonstrate to the president that they didn't support them.
Oh, I hate to do this. Thanks so much to Karen Korematsu for speaking to us. We've got more, and we'll return to our discussion with Karen next week. In the meantime, our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
Behind them, they left shops and homes they had occupied for many years. Their fishing fleets were impounded and left under guard. Now they were taken to racetracks and fairgrounds where the Army almost overnight had built assembly centers. They lived here until new pioneer communities could be completed on federally owned lands in the interior. The Army provided housing and plenty of healthful, nourishing food for all. We are setting a standard for the rest of the world in the treatment of people who may have loyalties to an enemy nation. We are protecting ourselves without violating the principles of Christian decency. And we won't change this fundamental decency no matter what our enemies do. But of course, we hope most earnestly that our example will influence the Axis powers in their treatment of Americans who fall into their...